This is Julie at Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello, and welcome to episode 15 of Dogcast Radio. We have a fascinating interview with Dr. Stanley Corran.
We know, for example, that lots of retrievers tend to lose their hearing as they grow older, that lots of terriers tend to get the dimmed sight and that sort of thing. So if your dog, for example, loses his hearing, he still has the visual channel of information for you to communicate with him, and vice versa.
And in our latest fiction feature, there was a fire, and his canine companion had woken him, had saved him. Immediately, he knew what he must do, and started knocking loudly on doors, shouting "Fire!" at the top of his voice, while his dog barked alongside him. Do you always listen right to the end of Dogcast Radio? Well, if you do, you'll have been hearing some quality jokes. And if you haven't, make sure you do this time. Before all that, we've had many guests on Dogcast Radio, but this is our first mystery one, Dog Lady. She's a lady, she has a dog, and a website, Ask Dog Lady, where the rest of us can go for advice about the problems that sometimes crop up when you share your life with a dog. For anyone who hasn't seen your website, would you like to tell us what Ask Dog Lady is about?
Basically, Ask Dog Lady is every question about you and your dog that you were afraid to ask all those all-knowing experts. Dog Lady deals with a lot of questions that have nothing to do with health or aggressive behavior, except on your part, of course.
Excellent.
But basically, I'm a journalist and have written for years for newspapers. And when I got my dog, basically, well, you know the feeling of having a dog. I mean, the whole world opens up to you. And I did a lot of reading when I first got my dog. And there was nothing that I really wanted to read. There were, you know, I would say the best dog book, and I have this on my site, is Caroline Knapp's A Pack of Two, which is a wonderful book written in a great literary style about getting a dog and what it means. But, you know, I tried going onto message boards and was always shooed off for being too dumb, and I just thought, you know, I need to write something that just, that is funny, because there's so much humor in dogs. And we'll deal with all these questions about the etiquette surrounding humans and dogs. Dog Lady's basic philosophy is all dogs are perfect, it's the humans that need help.
Yep, I'd agree with that. So when you got your dog, was it a puppy or was it fully grown?
It was a 10-week-old puppy.
Oh, lovely, lovely.
Yeah, he was. And I was very undecided about getting a dog. I mean, we had had dogs in my childhood, but they were always my brother's dogs or my mother took care of them. I hadn't ever had a dog of my own. And I really don't know what angel sat on my shoulder and encouraged this. But I had suffered some reverses in life. My mother had died. My favorite aunt had died. And I was just really very, just a little bit, you know, I was very successful at my job, but there was something missing. And I got my dog. And when I got this alien creature, this 10-week-old puppy, I kept the dog. I did everything that they tell you not to do in the books, although I hadn't read the books yet. But they say, you know, keep the new puppy in your bedroom in a crate right next to you, let him or her hear your heartbeat, blah, blah, blah. I did the absolute reverse. I had him in another room in a crate in a big caged area. I kept him as emotionally far apart from me as possible. And then I remember the morning when I went into, and I trained him like a military general. I was unyielding about, I think my record was 12 times out in one day. I do remember the morning. It was about 5 or 6 weeks after I'd gotten him. And I went in to get him at 5:30 in the morning to take him out. And he came out of his little crate. And Now, granted, it was all very comfortable. I mean, he wasn't kept in any harsh condition. He just was kept at arm's length from me.
Yeah.
And I went to get him, and he came out with his little rump wagging, and I looked at him, and I burst into song. The song was Mr. Sandman that I amended to suit him. And from that moment on, I was totally smitten. That bonding moment.
Yeah, yeah. I think as well, sometimes you say, you know, taking him out 12 times. I got totally obsessed with toilet training and, you know, putting him on the paper. And I got absolutely obsessed. And he would go and hide under the dining room table and poo. So then I moved the dining room table into the middle of the room so he couldn't hide from me. And my low point was one Saturday evening and he was about to poo. And I realised, and I grabbed him and ran to the paper. Well, of course, he carried on pooing, so then I had this trail of poop all through, all across the carpet, and I just thought, what am I doing? You know, and it was...
You have those moments.
Yes.
You have those moments where you go, what am I doing? Another one of my moments was when I took my dog, my little puppy, who it was born in July. I got him in early October, and in December, we got our first snow. And I took him out in that first snow, and you know, a new puppy, well, every dog, when they're in snow, with new snow, it obscures all the scents, so they don't know where to go. And they're very confused. And this puppy, I kept seeing that he was trying to do something, and he would move, and he was very confused. And I got very mad at him. And at that point, I took him inside, and I kind of hugged him close, and I started to cry. And I go, what am I doing? I'm so sorry.
It's lots of...
We impose so much of ourselves on our dogs. So much of our own expectations about everything from our need for control to our need for love to our need for fun. These are all issues that Dog Lady deals with. And I must tell you that I started my site on March 19th, 2003. I know the date because it was the day the war in Iraq started. And I like to say that Dog Lady did her little bit for world peace on that day. But that this many years later, my site is visited by over 50,000 people a month. And I get hundreds of letters from all over the world, and I can't possibly answer everyone. And many of them are inappropriate for me to answer because I make it very clear on my site, and I'll give the address, www.askdoglady.com, that I'm not a vet, nor do I play one on the internet. But I get hundreds of questions, but so many people get the spirit of Dog Lady, and now I'm just so touched by all the... I think a lot of people love their dogs and just want to tell stories about their dogs and themselves.
Yeah, I think it's such a roller coaster ride, particularly your first dog. That's the one where you make the mistakes and, you know, you learn the lessons.
And then your first dog, and then it's like any romance. The ardor dies, you know, you become bored with your dog. There are times when you're very bored with your dog because your dog always does the same thing. Your dog is the one dependable creature in your life.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Buddy keeps me on my toes. I've never got bored with him yet. He's a black Labrador, and he's full of different ideas and ways to manipulate you and make you convince you he's still hungry, actually, and things like this.
Well, they come up with these new ways, but they're such creatures of habit, I find. And that's one of the life's great soothing things, that your dog is so dependable and reliable. And
yeah. They can definitely tell the time, can't they?
Yeah. They can't tell the time.
Yes.
Thank goodness. They tell the time by when you arrive and leave.
And I always find when it's about 9 o'clock at night, Bud sort of starts it nudging me and sort of saying, I haven't been fed yet, you know. I haven't had my dinner, you know. And he gets so intense, and if I'm trying to do something, you know, and it's like, just wait, it's not convenient yet. And he's still there looking very disgruntled, saying, I haven't been fed yet, you know.
They are funny.
Yeah, yeah. So if anybody's got a question that is not medical and not about aggression, apart from, as you say, human aggression, if they've got a burning question, you're the lady to put it to.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example of what I have on my site at the moment. I should also point out that I write Ask Dog Lady 2 as a column for newspapers. And it's in 8 newspapers around Massachusetts.
Right.
And I'm seeking to expand it nationally and, I hope, internationally.
Mm-hmm.
I have readers, a lot of readers from Britain and Australia and all over the world, actually. People have, and I'm sure you get this at your website, that you get people who listen from all over the world.
Yeah, yeah. The internet is wonderful, isn't it? Because it just takes all those barriers down.
It really does. Mm. It really does.
Mm.
But I have a question. I just posted this on my website today. And I kind of like this question because it's very indicative of Dog Lady. And this is a question from a mother who's... I assume it's a mother, the person's name is Aubrey, whose daughter was going off to college, going back to college for a new semester, and wanted to take the dog, the family dog, with her. And the dog's name is London. So, and the mother was saying, look, you know, I love the dog too, but she seems to want to bring the dog back to college with her, and is this a good idea? And Dog Lady answered, Aubrey, best to keep London, this is the dog, London, on your side of the pond. A college dorm is not a suitable environment for a pampered pet used to the comforts of home. And then what I always try to do with Dog Lady is look for a deeper human angle on this. And what I kind of try to suggest to this mother is that maybe her daughter is homesick at college, and maybe, you know, wanting to bring the dog back to college is something deeper than just wanting to bring the dog back to college. A need for comfort, a need for just a more of a connection to home, and that I suggest that the mother have a heart-to-heart with the daughter before she goes back to college, but not to bring the family pet back to college.
Yeah, yeah.
But always what Dog Lady tries to do is I try to always give it a little bit of humor, and I said, you know, that the London, the dog, already has her PhD in home economics. And that she will always be your daughter's devoted sorority sister. So.
Lovely. Well, there you go. If you have a dog-related problem or a question to ask, ask Dog Lady. There's a link to her site on the Dogcast site. You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Properly trained, a man can be a dog's best friend. Corey Ford.
Two-Minute Fiction. Do What You've Got to Do. Written by Julie Hill. Mr. Williams was old and alone, except for his devoted and beloved dog. When his wife had become ill, she had been philosophical about it. She had had a good long life, and it was time. As she put it, you do what you've got to do, and you go. When she had gone, both Mr. Williams and his dog grieved for her, and it was only having each other that got them through. They were both getting on in years, and visits to the vet became more frequent. Then there was the dreadful time when the dog had an alarming fit right there in the vet surgery. A nurse had discreetly ushered Mr. Williams into the waiting room, where he waited apprehensively. However, within a few moments, his dog trotted out to him, and she had not trotted in a long time. She seemed a lot better, and the old man was very grateful to the young vet. The old man and his dog lived in the top apartment of a small block, and one night the dog woke her master in a state of agitation. He rose from his bed and followed her down the hallway, where she waited, barking for him. His sight and hearing might be dimming, but there was nothing wrong with his sense of smell, and even before he opened his front door, it hit him. Smoke. There was a fire, and his canine companion had woken him, had saved him. Immediately, he knew what he must do, and started knocking loudly on doors, shouting "Fire!" at the top of his voice, while his dog barked alongside him. That evening in the local bar, two men were already standing at the counter when a third walked shakily in and ordered a large whiskey, which he downed quickly. He shuddered slightly as he waited for it to take effect. His two fellow drinkers eyed him with distaste, but interest. "Bad day?" the bartender asked. The newcomer nodded. "I'm a firefighter, and we were called to a small apartment block just down the road last night. I couldn't stop thinking about it. I had to come back and have another look." "What happened?" prompted the bartender, who was used to handing out therapy with the drinks. "It was awful. Rainbow Gardens, it's called, the apartment block. Anyway, apparently this old fellow who lived in the apartment at the top, well, his dog woke him up. Then the fellow and his dog, they woke everyone else. When we got there, the fire had taken hold of the building, but we were told everyone had got out." He paused while he gathered his thoughts. "Then, afterwards, no one could find the old man. He was in the building. He must have been. Poor old man. He saves everyone else, and then burns to death himself. It hurts me whenever we lose anyone, but this one really churned me up." While the firefighter pushed his glass over the counter for a refill, the man nearest to him spoke. "Rainbow Gardens? Are you talking about Mr. Williams?" the man asked. The firefighter took a more measured sip of his drink this time and nodded. "Yes, that's right. Williams was his name." The other man spoke again. "Well, Mr. Williams used to bring his dog to me. I'm a vet. My surgery's near here, and you've got the story slightly wrong. Mr. Williams did have a dog, but she was very old and ill. He nursed her along, absolutely loved that dog. But I'm afraid about 3 months ago, the dog died. Had a fit right on the examining table and died. Nothing I could do." The vet paused. The scene was obviously vivid in his mind. He continued, "The worst of it was, he just couldn't take it in. Kept thanking me, shaking my hand. And another thing, he always used to walk that dog past my surgery, morning and then about 5, regular as clockwork. Well, after the dog died, he couldn't seem to understand he didn't have to walk her. And there he'd be, still walking past, giving me a cheery wave. I felt so sorry for him, but there was nothing I could do." The third man was regarding the other two with a mix of puzzlement and pity. "Now listen here," he started, and he was clearly used to people listening when he told them to. "I'm the local doctor, and Mr. Williams of Rainbow Gardens was one of my patients. I saw him regularly, although I never met his dog. You're both mistaken. Mr. Williams' own health had deteriorated severely towards the end of his life. He would not have been able to wake anyone and save them from a fire last night, nor would he have been bringing his dog to you, much less walking her past your surgery on a daily basis. You see, 6 months ago, Mr. Williams died." The three men stood staring at each other, and the bartender himself paused. Even in his line of work, you didn't hear stories like that every day. That was Do What You've Got to Do, written by Julie Hill.
Dogs come when they are called. Cats take a message and get back to you. Mary Bly.
Recently, one of our listeners, Barbara Footnalong, apologies if I got the pronunciation wrong there, contacted me with some work by Dr. Stanley Coren that she had found interesting. I was fascinated with his idea of using signs as a way of aiding communication with your dog in old age. We went on to talk about many subjects, but first we talked about why to use signs with dogs at all. Could you tell me, how does including signs improve communication with my dog?
Well, it does so in a number of ways. The first thing is that it gives the dog an extra channel of information. So it's very much like what goes on in the television, okay? If somebody flashes up a brand name and then says it at the same time, you have two channels of information, so you're more likely to get it. So dogs tend to respond better to both signal and voice when they're given at the same time. At the same time, it has a long-term effect, which is quite good, and we call this age-proofing. We know, for example, that lots of retrievers tend to lose their hearing as they grow older, that lots of terriers tend to get the dim sight and that sort of thing. So if your dog, for example, loses his hearing, he still has the visual channel of information for you to communicate with him, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a number of years ago, we went to a dog obedience competition, and in the veterans class, there was a 13-year-old little Shetland sheepdog, and Noelle performed her exercises really quite nicely. And nobody except the people who were very friendly with the handler knew that that dog had gone stone deaf 6 months before.
Mm.
And she went prancing out with a big pink rosette. and there was still a communication channel. So that's some of the advantages of using both signal and sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, obviously this is an advantage in training, but something that had never occurred to me before was this ability to still praise your dog, you know, to give him that pleasure of the praise if
yes.
he loses his hearing.
Yeah, that's something, I mean, all of us forget that. I inherited a little old dog, Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, and he was about 70% deaf, and he had never been trained to signals, so I knew while we still had some hearing with him, I should start to train him to signals because I was going to need them. And he was going much slower than I thought it would because, you know, I know his breed well, and he was he's a bright little thing. And then it suddenly dawned upon me, I had forgotten a sort of a good dog kind of signal. I mean, so I use a double hand flash to tell him, you know, this is a good thing what you did. And by the way, if you train dogs to certain signals, you know, you can avoid certain problems. For example, let me give you sort of a very typical one. Everybody, you know, not everybody, but at least a lot of people are concerned about the fact that their dog jumps up on people. And, you know, although the draconian kinds of cures, which some people suggest, like kick your dog in the chest when he does it, that's it. You know, anybody who has any psychological training knows the best thing to do is to give your dog a competing exercise or give him competing response, which simply means something which if he's doing that, he can't be jumping up on. So the easiest thing to do is to tell the dog to sit. So when somebody approaches, you know, you tell the dog to sit, you give him a little cookie, and so he's not jumping up on Aunt Mildred because, you know, he's sitting. Well, that's fine if you're there, but, you know, how do you keep the dog from jumping up when you're not the first one on the scene or you're not there? Well, the easiest way to do this is to teach your dog a second signal for sit. And that second signal is simply you hold both hands out in front of you with the fingers up and the palms toward the dog.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy to train the dog to that, you know, once he's already learned how to sit to the word. Now, what happens then is when Aunt Mildred arrives and you're not there and the dog goes running toward her, well, the natural thing which people do is they hold up their hands in that way. And your dog then sees that and knows that's a sit signal. So they sit down and you don't have a dog jumping up in her nice white dress.
Oh, that's excellent. That's a good trick. That's outwitting the dog. I like that. Are there any, you've sort of dealt with hearing and mentioned sight. Are there any other ways that we can help sort of age-proof our dogs? Because I had sort of, I have a Labrador, and so I'd sort of thought of helping, he's only three at the moment, I'd sort of thought of helping him grow older as well as he can, sort of giving him good quality food, making sure he has the right kind of exercise, not too strenuous, keeping his weight down. But I'd never thought of sort of doing this proactive age-proofing.
Yeah, well, the behavioral aspects are really important, and because most of the things which drive us crazy, you know, about our dogs are behaviors which they get involved in. And if you set things up, so there's a routine, then dogs learn very easily. So, you know, if, for example, you lived in the same place for a long period of time, and you haven't moved the furniture around very much, you know, your dog could go quite blind, and you would not necessarily notice it, because, you know, they will negotiate really quite well, you know, around the place without, you know, any noticeable deficits, simply because they know the place. Now, there are a couple of things which you can do to guarantee that your dog gets the full complement of his senses. One of the things you can do is, or he is not do, is to clip his whiskers. The whiskers, I mean, they're not really whiskers. So technically, there's something which we call vibrissa. They're a special kind of a hair, and they're designed to when the light is low, to provide information for the dog as to where surfaces are and walls are and that sort of thing. Mm. And they are so sensitive, they can actually pick up the change in air pressure as you approach a surface.
Mm.
So, you know, I mean, obviously in the show ring, they're like those sort of snipped off, but it's actually a deficit to the dog. And especially when the dog is older and you have the fear that, in fact, you know, senses might be dimming a bit, you know, leave those on and that'll keep them from bumping into things.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing which you can do is, as the dog grows older, if you think that his vision is dimming, you can start to make your signals, to exaggerate them, to make them really big movements. Because the dog's eye is very, very sensitive to movement. A dog, for example, can recognize his master at a mile away if his master is moving. But if his master's standing still at just 100 yards, he might not recognize him.
Mm-hmm.
So when the dog's eyes are starting to dim, one of the things which you should do is you should use really big signals. And the same thing if things are confusing, you know, if there's lots of people around and lots of things going on. Those really big signals make it much easier for the dog to see you. So, for example, with my dogs, my come signal is I reach my right hand out slightly to the side and then make a big movement to touch my left shoulder. Now, that's a really big movement, and my dogs pick it up from a far distance.
Mm. Yes, I had come across sort of you make the recall signal a big one so that they can see it from the distance. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Are there any other sort of behaviours that really lend themselves well to signs?
Oh yeah, I mean, there are lots of behaviours. You have to remember that for dogs, the visual signals, the sort of reading body language, is much more efficient in some respects than reading sounds. And if you think of it, dogs come from pack hunting animals. Now, suppose that we've got a pack of wolves, and we'll call them the ancestors of the dogs, and the leader of the pack sees, a deer, if he yells to the rest of his pack, hey guys, there's a deer over there, well, guess what? The deer has heard it too, and they've just lost lunch.
Aww.
So dogs have become sort of the ultimate masters of reading body language. And that's one of the reasons why you get some people thinking that dogs have ESP, you know. You know, my dog knew right away when I walked, you know, I walked in the house that, you know, Fred and I had broken up or something like that. Well, in fact, you know, the dog reads those changes in your body language and picks them up very quickly.
It's interesting because they do pick up very subtle things. I mean, one silly thing is if I pick up the keys to the shed in the garden, then Buddy is there at the shed before I am. Because he knows that's where I'm going. And you think, well, you little swine, why can't you pick up that quickly? I don't want you to pull on the lead.
Well, part of the reason, for example, pulling on the lead is just a matter of rewards. You know, the dog pulls on the lead. He's a lab. So he's, what, 60 pounds or 65 pounds or something like that? And, you know, he hits to the end of that lead going at 30 miles an hour, and guess what? He moves you along.
Yes.
So it's successful. Now, the simplest way to get a dog not to pull on the lead is every time he hits the end of the lead, I mean, depending upon how large you are, you may have to hold the leash with both hands, you spin around and go in the other direction. So no matter when he hits the lead, which is the idea is to move you along and to stay ahead of you, he always finds himself following you and you going in the other direction. Now, of course, the neighbors might think that you've been tippling a little bit for breakfast in the morning walk if they see you reversing your course several times. But after a very short time, or, you know, depending upon how long your dog has been doing this, he'll get the idea that whenever he hits the end of that lead with any force at all, he's going to end up behind you and going in a direction he doesn't want. And dogs are sensible enough to understand those things that work and those things that don't.
And we seem to be getting to the point now where his energy is, I mean, I'd say he's only three, but that sort of the tons of energy puppy stage is beginning to, we're getting the glimmer of the end of it. And he's kind of just worn down. He's like, oh, all right, then I won't pull so much. But that's...
well, that's part of it. I mean, you have to remember for labs, it takes them 18 months, 2 years to get their brain. It's always in back order. And then by the time they're four or five, you're writing poems about them. So he's in the transition stage.
Yes. He's lovely, but it's a long time getting there.
it's a long time getting there. That's very much the case with the bigger sporting dogs. I mean, it's the same way with the setters.
But, I mean, that mad enthusiasm is part of their charm, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, you know, I have... a collection of dogs, and you know, I always have at least one very active one and one couch potato. You know, different dogs for different moods and that sort of thing. And the thing about it is, when the active ones start to slow down, you really start to miss it. You know, it tells you something which you wish that the boss was not whispering in your ears.
Do all dog breeds benefit from the signs added to training?
Oh, yes, yes. It's some dogs are much more sensitive to movement than other dogs. These would be the sight hounds, so things like the greyhound, the whippet, the Afghan hound, the deerhound, that sort of thing. Because their job in life is to see something moving and to run it down. However, any dog will benefit by it. Now, obviously, you know, a beagle or a bloodhound or a foxhound, you know, while he's out coursing, his nose is to the ground. And so if you don't have line of sight, then, I mean, obviously, if that scent has caught his attention, then it's going to be more difficult to get him to respond. And that's the time when you need sort of a real distinctive kind of a sound. That's why they use the horns to control the foxhound. You know, that helps because it's such a distinctive sound that it sort of cuts through even when they're on scent. But all dogs benefit by it.
Yeah.
As, you know, if they've got the sight, then that's all they need.
And just on a personal note, how did the psychology and dogs come together for you, or has it always been sort of together?
Well, I mean, I've had dogs all my life, and, you know, always trained them and competed with them and tried to understand them. And, you know, I became a psychologist because I was interested in behavior. Now I'm fairly lucky in terms of my training, and that is I'm trained in both human and animal behavior. And that makes me a bit of a rare breed, because most psychologists are either trained for human behavior or they're trained for animal behavior. But my major interests really are the human-animal bond. And part of the bond is the ability to communicate with one another. And that requires, you know, knowledge of both species. You know, way back when I was young, and the stegosaur, I was still roaming the earth, back in the late 1940s, there was a radio program for which featured Lassie.
Mm.
And, you know, all of the barking was actually done by the original Lassie, Pal, and all the growls and whines and whimpers were done by human actors. But anyway, Lassie would come running into the kitchen and bark at the mother, and the mother would go, "Oh my God, Timmy was playing with the tractor again, and the tractor rolled over, and he needs help. Now I'm going to run out to the pasture, and you run over to the Smith place and get Doc Connors," and, you know, and Lassie would dash out and would run over to the Smith place and bark at Doc Connors, and he would understand exactly what she was saying and run. And that used to drive me absolutely crazy, because, you know, my dog at the time was a little beagle, and you know, he knew his name, sort of, and would come sometimes, and you know, and I knew when he was happy, but he sort of wagged his tail, but, you know, and I knew when he was hungry, because he was just breathing, and that was about it. I mean, you know, and that puzzle, I really wanted, you know, wanted to go get King Solomon's ring so I could understand what the animals were saying, and in some respects, you know, I've just been very fortunate. You know, I reached a stage in my career where I could turn from the neuropsychological studies, which, you know, earned me my position in the Royal Society, and move on to studying the human-animal bond and looking at animals, and particularly dogs, which are my fascination.
Once you've lived with them, I think, once you start to get a little insight into what they're actually thinking, not what you project onto them. And I think it's addictive then, because you think, I need to know more. I need to know really what he's thinking, what that movement means.
And it makes a huge difference. Okay, you know, people don't recognize that most dogs do not survive the first year. That 40% of all dogs do not survive the first year with the family which originally bought them.
Mm.
And that's a huge number. Mm. And, you know, obviously in some cases it's a matter of choices. I mean, you know, somebody who's a quiet, sedate person, you know, buys a Jack Russell, I mean, and just suddenly has their life torn apart. But in other cases, it's simply because they don't understand, you know, what is going on and what the dog is trying to say and how to communicate to the dog. And they become frustrated, and they give the dog back to the breeder or give it up to a shelter, you know, take it to the vet for a needle. And I find that's a tragedy. And that's part of the reason why I study this sort of thing, because I really like to sort of stop that kind of thing, which is obviously bad for the dog, but it's also bad for the person, because it's denying them a form of companionship through ignorance, you know, and it's not because they're dumb, it's just because they're not educated as to what to look for and how to respond.
And then they're left with the feeling of failure as well. And yeah.
Well, they're left with the feeling of failure, you know, their kid grows up without a dog, and we know all the benefits of kids and dogs, you know, it's not a good thing.
I think...
And, and, and there's a sense of betrayal. You know, you feel betrayed by the dog, or you feel as though you have betrayed the dog.
I think that's a very important message to get out there. If it's broke, you can fix it.
And the real secret here is simply understanding. And you know, I, for example, when I'm dealing with trying to talk in general about dog behavior to most people, it turns out that the really, you know, there's a really critical key that you can give to people, which improves their relationship, you know, manyfold. And that is that the average dog has the mental abilities roughly equivalent to a 2-year-old human child. And the super dogs, the dogs in the top 20%, have the mental abilities of roughly a 2.5-year-old. So if you stop and you say to yourself, well, what does that mean? Well, that means that, in fact, dogs, you know, will have all the basic emotions. They will have, you know, fear, anger, surprise, happiness, that sort of thing. But they won't have the learned emotions like, you know, guilt. I mean, guilt takes a child till about 3.5 years of age to get some glimmering of. And I teach university, and I sometimes wonder whether 18-year-olds have learned it yet. you know, so they're not going to have that. And it's also important to note that they have the social consciousness of a teenager. You know, they're really interested in, you know, who's moving up, who's seeing who, who's sleeping with who, and that sort of thing. And so you take those two things together, social consciousness of a teenager and the mind of a 2-2.5-year-old, and you can simply ask the question, you know, would a 2.5-year-old understand what I'm saying? You know, and if he won't, then in fact, you know, not even your dog.
No, no. So don't set him up to fail.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and you know, now, they, when I talk about, you know, a 2-2.5-year-old, you know, that might sound like it's a minimal amount of ability, but it means that the average dog can understand about 165, you know, words, signs, signals, that sort of stuff, and the super dogs can understand in excess of 250. So, you know, that's quite a reasonable capacity. I mean, you know, I know 500 words in French, and I can sort of stagger my way through a French-speaking community, making myself understood. Well, you know, 250 words is a lot.
Well, that's excellent. Thank you. I mean, on a personal level, thank you very much, because you've opened a whole new avenue and area to explore of sort of helping my dog. You know,
well, I hope so.
Yeah.
And give him a pat for me.
Well, I will do. Well, thank you very much for your time, Dr. Corran.
All right. Bye-bye.
He was absolutely fascinating to talk with, and I shall definitely be reading his books, How to Talk Dog and How Dogs Think, both of which there are links to on our site, along with a link to Dr. Corran's own site. Many thanks to Barbara for introducing me to Dr. Corran's work.
Don't make the mistake of treating your dogs like humans, or they'll treat you like dogs. Martha Scott. And now, for our younger listeners, it's Puppy Playtime. Hi, and welcome to Puppy Playtime. I have been researching the association between dogs and royalty. Queen Elizabeth II of England loves dogs, and felt that if she had not been born to be queen, she would have liked to be a lady living in the country with lots of horses and dogs. The close relationship between powerful rulers and dogs is not a recent development, though. Chihuahuas were associated with the ancient royals of the Aztecs. King Arthur favoured hunting dogs. King John in the 13th century had otterhounds, and William the Conqueror introduced bloodhounds to England. The much-married Henry VIII had more success with dogs than wives, it seems. He introduced the Maltese Terrier, to England, as well as enjoying coursing stags with greyhounds and appreciating the company of Cocker Spaniels. It has to be said that dogs have returned the devotion of their monarchs who loved them. After Mary, Queen of Scots, was beheaded, a Skye Terrier was found hiding in her skirts and had to be dragged away from its mistress. King Charles II of England adored the breed named after him. His favourite spaniel gave birth to a litter of puppies in her royal master's bed. Such was his enthusiasm for his dogs that he passed a law that the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel was not to be denied entry anywhere in the land. This law has never been repealed, and it would be interesting to put it to the test. Queen Victoria boosted many dog breeds. She encountered the Border Collie in 1871 at Balmoral Castle, and being attracted by their beauty, spirit and devotion, she welcomed them into her royal kennel. She saw Pomeranians in Florence and brought them back to England. Prince Albert introduced his wife to the Dachshund breed, and amongst others, the Queen was given Japanese Chins from Japan, where they had a long history of association with royalty. And China sent Chow Chows as a present. Pugs were introduced to England by William III and also beloved by George III and Edward VIII, later the Duke of Windsor. The King of Thailand has written a book about his favourite dog, crossbreed Copper. Modern British royalty still love their dogs too. Queen Elizabeth is patron of the Kennel Club. The Queen is renowned for her corgis, but also favours Labradors and Spaniels. The late Princess Margaret liked Sealyhams and Dachshunds. The occasional meeting between corgis and Dachshund led to the crossbreed dubbed Doggies. The Labrador is a favourite amongst all the modern British royals, with Jack Russell Terriers also admired. Princess Anne owns greyhounds, bloodhounds, clumber spaniels and her infamous bull terriers. You can see that if you like dogs, you are in good company. Maybe these powerful people enjoy the company of dogs because they relate to you as you are, not being swayed by many opposition. It must be comforting to know that when a dog wags their tail or gives you a lick, he generally loves you. But then, I suppose that's the enjoyment we all get from our dogs. Bye for now, and remember to have fun with your dog and make sure that your dog has fun with you. To err is human, to forgive canine, unknown.
I recently came across the story of a dog in need of help. Misa is a 3-year-old Australian Kelpie dog. His owners rescued him from the Helen Woodward Animal Centre and are devoted to him. Sadly, not long ago during his walk near Del Mar Dog Beach, San Diego, Misa made too energetic a lunge at a seagull near the cliff edge. The leash was pulled out of his owner's hand and he plunged down the 100-feet tall cliffs. He survived, but now faces long and expensive surgery on his broken front legs. Misa has already fought off a fungal lung infection and survived being bitten by a rattlesnake. His family are determined to see him through his latest illness, but will have trouble raising the money for the treatment. If you would like to help by making a donation towards Misa's treatment, you can find the address to do so on the Dogcast site. Any money left at the end of the treatment will be donated to the shelter Misa was rescued from. We wish him a speedy recovery. Now, turning to the news. A survey carried out for Burgess Superdog caught my attention. The survey found that dog owners think the best dog breed to be the Prime Minister of Britain would be a Labrador. It was felt that the friendly, loyal qualities of the Labrador would make a great leader. Other breeds people thought would have the qualities to be a good Prime Minister included the German Shepherd and the Border Collie. In contrast to the Labrador, the best breed for the leader of the opposition was considered to be a Doberman. It just shows it's a dog-eat-dog world in politics. We're still adding to our dog breed profiles on the Dogcast site, and many of you have added photos of your dog, which is brilliant. They're great to look at, and I hope everyone else will enjoy having a look at them. If you haven't done so yet, do send us a photo and a comment about your dog. We're getting a steady stream of emails from people who enjoy Dogcast Radio, and thank you very much. It's always lovely to get feedback. As I said earlier in the show, it was one of our listeners who introduced me to Dr. Stanley Coren's work, which I'm going to have fun exploring. If you've come across an author or a book or a website that you think the rest of us would enjoy, please do send it in and we'll follow it up. Till next time, look after yourself and your dogs. And remember, do keep listening to the end if you want to hear the joke. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121-288-0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
What's the most likely time that a stray dog would come into your house? When the door's open.